Public Startup: How America's Least Likely Government Program Became Its Boldest Experiment. Audition. Chapter 8: The Florida Paradox. On a hot and humid afternoon in May 2011, as cicadas buzzed from palm and pine outside the Capitol walls, 100 people sat silent in the air-conditioned hush of the Florida Senate chamber. The Republican Senate president yielded the floor to Senator Joe Negron in a dark gray suit, who slowly rose and brought a handheld microphone to his lips. What he said startled his colleagues. "What I'm proposing here today," he declared, "is the most significant transformational change in the Medicare program since it was created." Then he did something rare in the politics of public assistance. He offered respect. "I think it's important that people on Medicaid are treated as first-class citizens. They shouldn't have a big M stamped on their forehead that they're somehow in a different part of the waiting room at the doctor's office. They should receive the same health care as people on Medicare and people with private health insurance policies. We want to treat them fairly in the way we would want to be treated if the situation were reversed." A day later, across the marbled rotunda in the Florida House chamber, Republican Representative Rob Schenck added his own support. "We get to save billions of dollars, and we get to deliver better health care." Representative Gail Harrell followed with a flourish. "Thank you, Representative Schenck and Senator Negron, for really moving us forward into the 21st century and how we're going to look after our Medicaid patients." And then, 1 month later, Republican Governor Rick Scott, a former hospital executive, Tea Party favorite, and longtime critic of government health programs, signed the reform into law. These weren't gaffes, not re-election rhetoric, not political theater designed to troll the opposition. They were full-throated, deliberate endorsements of publicly funded health care. To most observers outside the state, this would seem impossible. Florida, the same state that bans books, fluoride, and Medicaid expansion, was cheering on the very program it so often denounced. And yet here was its Republican leadership applauding Medicaid, not begrudgingly, not with caveats, but with the kind of glowing praise usually reserved for tax cuts, gun rights, and college football. This wasn't a moment of ideological surrender. It was something unexpected and more interesting. It was the beginning of a public sector experiment masquerading as a cost control measure. And like all paradoxes, it began with contradiction. To understand why this was so surprising, you must understand Florida. But to understand Florida, you have to begin in a railroad boomtown of 19th century Iowa. In America, an invisible yet consequential divide shapes how states and cities operate. Dillon's rule versus home rule. The former comes from Judge John Forrest Dillon, a 19th century Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court, who believed local governments were too disorganized to be trusted with power, especially at a time when railroads and private interests often pulled the strings. His solution was to restrict local authority to only what state legislatures expressly permitted. Courts embraced this simple top-down framework, and Dillon's rule became the dominant legal doctrine in most of the country. But not everywhere. In the South, where post-Reconstruction constitutions reflected deep mistrust of centralized government, and where counties, not cities, formed the backbone of political life, many states wrote into law the opposite philosophy. Home rule granted counties broad powers to legislate on local matters unless specifically barred or preempted by the state. It wasn't just a legal quirk, it was a reflection of political culture, born of states that wanted to keep power close to home. Nowhere is this more alive than in Florida. Unlike most states beholden to Dillon's rule, Florida enshrines home rule in its constitution and takes it a step further with its unusually high number of charter counties. A charter county is a county that has adopted its own constitution-like charter, approved by voters, that allows it to govern itself with even greater autonomy. Today, more than 20 of Florida's 67 counties operate under such charters, including most of its largest population centers. The result? A state composed not of uniform counties acting in lockstep, but of semi-sovereign local governments, each with its own policy levers, legal frameworks, and appetite for experimentation. This makes Florida an outlier. It's a state where innovation is not only allowed at the local level, but also expected. While much of the country might see Medicaid as a monolithic federal program administered by states, Florida's decentralized DNA gave rise to a version of Medicaid shaped by charter counties, tailored pilots, and regional reforms. It's not chaos, it's structured improvisation. And that structure, counterintuitive though it may be, is precisely what makes Florida a launchpad for one of the most ambitious Medicaid overhauls in the country. Before the 1990s, Florida was defined less by ideological clarity and more by regional fragmentation, measured governance, and shifting allegiances. It was a state in transition best described as culturally southern, demographically northern, and politically eclectic. The Florida of the mid-20th century didn't yet wear a red or blue jersey. It wore a patchwork jacket like the Seminole Tawakachi. Throughout much of the 20th century, Florida straddled multiple worlds. In the North and Panhandle regions, it was part of the Deep South, with one-party democratic rule, racial segregation, and conservative social values. But to the South, particularly in Miami-Dade and Palm Beach counties, a different electorate was taking shape. One that was more urban, more immigrant-rich, and more attuned to national politics. Central Florida, meanwhile, was evolving from citrus and cattle farmlands into a suburban sprawl magnet. The arrival of Walt Disney World in 1971 catalyzed this transformation, turning Orlando into a bellwether of American consumer culture and drawing tens of thousands of new residents from the Northeast and Midwest. Northern businesses relocated headquarters to Orlando to expand and grow. Tourists to the state paid enough in sales taxes and road tolls to obviate the need for both personal and business income taxes, levies that remain absent even to this day. Newcomers to Florida came for warmer weather and a lower tax bill, but still wanted the scaffolding of civic life intact. Many were Democrats or moderate Republicans who voted for candidates promising efficiency, not revolution. But when this political eclecticism met Florida's tradition of minimal governance, a new hybrid began to form. It wasn't ideological purity that was ruled. It was practical, consumer-minded politics. People wanted services, yes, but they wanted them cheap. They valued order, safety, growth, and low taxes. The ballot box became less a forum for philosophical expression and more a feedback loop, rewarding whoever made things work better, faster, cheaper, and more visibly. That convergence between suburban expectations and Florida's anti-tax pre-growth machinery reshaped the state's entire political center of gravity. Florida was technically a Democratic state well into the 1980s, but its Democratic Party bore little resemblance to the national one. It was conservative, segregationist, and business-friendly, a vestige of the solid South. Many of its legislators had been in office for decades, protected by incumbency and district maps that rarely changed. In statewide elections, however, Republicans were making inroads. Presidential contests told the story. Florida voted for Richard Nixon in 1968 and again in his 1972 landslide. It supported Ronald Reagan twice, and in 1988 went to George H.W. Bush by a wide margin. Yet even as Florida leaned Republican in federal elections, state politics remained mixed. Governors like Reuben Askew from 1971 to 1979 and Bob Graham from 1979 to 1987 were moderate Democrats who combined progressive social investments, particularly in education and environmental protection, with fiscally cautious budgets. They were consensus builders, not ideologues. Florida's political culture before the 1990s emphasized pragmatism over polarization. The legislature operated through personal relationships more than party-line loyalty. Committees wielded power, and many deals were cut sub rosa. The press referred to the state government as the Capitol in a singular, as if it were a place of institutional continuity rather than a partisan contest. Political reformers in the 1970s, particularly Governor Askew, ushered in ethics laws, judicial reforms, and sunshine statutes that gave Florida a reputation for transparency and professionalism. These moves were often bipartisan and earned Florida national praise as a model for clean governance. But beneath the surface, the ground was shifting. The steady migration of retirees, the growth of evangelical churches, the increasing influence of Cuban American voters in Miami since the 1980s, and the suburban expansion of cities like Tampa and Jacksonville began to reshape Florida's electoral map. By the late 1980s, Florida was no longer a southern backwater nor yet a Sunbelt powerhouse. It was politically up for grabs. The turning point came in the 1990s. In 1994, Jeb Bush ran for governor on a platform of school choice, privatization, and performance-based management. Though he narrowly lost, that same year Republicans gained control of the Florida Senate for the first time since Reconstruction. The Florida House followed soon after. By 1998, Bush returned to win the governorship, launching Florida's era of Republican dominance. Bush governed not through populist appeals, but through technocratic design. In education, he introduced test-based accountability. In state government operations, he used data and results. Florida didn't simply adopt conservative ideology, it institutionalized conservative management. The state began to look less southern and more like a private sector prototype of outcome-based governance. The state's national prominence leapt into focus in 2000. When the presidential election recount placed Florida not just on the map, but under a microscope. That fall, Americans spent their evenings transfixed by television screens, watching newscasters examine hanging chads and dimpled ballots with the solemnity of constitutional scholars and the suspense of courtroom drama. Counties became characters, voting machines became symbols, and Florida became the hinge on which national power swung. Yet, while the nation obsessed over butterfly ballots and legal appeals, Florida itself was undergoing a transformation. Beneath the chaos, the Republican Party was tightening its grip on the statehouse, building the machinery not just to win elections, but to govern with precision. The recount was a spectacle. The consolidation of conservative power was the deeper story. In 2010, Florida's trajectory sharpened with the election of Governor Rick Scott, a political outsider whose resume read like a case study in free market healthcare, complete with health insurance fraud allegations. Who better to redesign government than a wealthy executive who had mastered both the mechanics of profit and the consequences of overreach? Scott entered office at the crest of the Tea Party wave, vowing to slash regulation, shrink government, and stand firmly against the Affordable Care Act. He spoke the language of libertarian restraint, but governed like a systems engineer. Scott didn't dismantle the machinery of the state, rather, he recalibrated it. Underneath his rhetoric and austerity, he expanded Florida's capacity to manage complexity by accelerating the redesign of the state's largest budget line item, Medicaid. If Governor Scott supplied the political will, State Senator Joe Negron brought the architectural design. A self-proclaimed libertarian, leaning Republican, known more for strategic pragmatism than ideological fervor, Negron led the legislative change for overhauling Florida's Medicaid program in 2011. When Negron pledged to improve Medicaid for low-income Floridians, he wasn't looking for a partisan brawl over government health care. He was trying to fix an expensive system that too often treated coverage like a scarlet letter stamped on people's foreheads. He reformed Medicaid, not by dismantling government, but by harnessing managed care and making it move faster, smarter, and more conditionally. Prior to the state's Medicaid reform in May 2011, Florida's Medicaid-managed care system functioned like a loosely organized farmer's market, with dozens of health plans operating under their own tents, setting their own rules with little coordination. The plans were in control. Contracts were vague. Oversight was thin. Some counties were dominated by a single insurer. Others had plans with little more than a P.O. box and a call center. The state was less a conductor than a bystander, watching from the wings as billions of public dollars flowed through private pipelines with minimal coordination. But that changed with an experiment. In the mid-2000s, Florida launched a Medicaid managed care demonstration in five counties, seeding what would become one of the most ambitious healthcare experiments in the country. As Paul Duncan recalled, what we think of as Medicaid reform in Florida, all of that started with Jeb Bush, legislatively led by Joe Negron and evaluated by the University of Florida. It was, in many ways, the public sector equivalent of a startup beta test. The state tried something bold by writing more detailed contracts, setting more specific performance targets, and seeing what happens when insurers are held accountable not for services delivered, but for outcomes achieved. Duncan remembered Governor Jeb Bush's conviction that enrollees should perceive Medicaid as if it were their own insurance. That was his idea, that the Medicaid money should follow the patient. It was a radical notion at the time. The pilot didn't solve everything, but it broke the mold and generated data. It exposed loopholes. It forced hospitals who had long demanded a bigger role in Medicaid to step up. We went through a year of hospitals demanding the opportunity to do this, Duncan said, and then when the bid was opened up, nobody came. It's a lot of work, and it's work they don't know how to do.